Have you ever wondered why some brands seem to break through while others simply fade out? On this week's episode of the Tomorrow Brands podcast, I'm speaking with Derek Springston, CEO of Boulder-based branding agency Moxie Sozo. Derek's worked with some of the most interesting challenge brands in the US, helping them build what he calls ecosystems for long-term success. We talk about why trends are often the beginning of the end, the danger of refreshing your brand just because you're bored, and what US brands could learn from UK brands and vice versa.
Hi, Derek. Thanks so much for joining us today. Before we get into it, I'd love to hear more about your background, where you are now and how you got there.
Thanks for having me. So my name is Derek Springston. I'm the CEO and managing partner at a branding agency called Moxie Sozo. We are based out of Boulder, Colorado, and so is our whole team of 30 plus folks. We're celebrating our fifth year in business this year, and it's been quite the ride for myself and some of my partners. We're not the original founders, but we purchased the agency from our founder about 6 years ago now. And that comes from a few of us starting as unpaid interns back when we were only about a 5 or 6 person team and helping grow the business from there. I had a few other stops in branding agencies, or one other stop, a hiatus, I like to call it, and then came back because of the people that I worked with and still work with to this day. As a lot of new folks have come in and out, there's a core few of us that have been along for the ride together, and I wouldn't change it.
So maybe we could start by talking about, always interested in hearing what's going on in the US. I think it's like a market that we all look to for trends, inspiration. You can tell a lot of brands here look for inspiration because their packaging is quite similar to the standouts in the categories in the US. So would love to hear your view on what is interesting in the US right now.
It's hard to ignore the business side right now, which are inflation, cost of goods, tariffs, all those factors that are playing a huge role in how these brands have to manage their businesses right now. But I think you're seeing the piece with trends, and I'll get to that word here in a second, but I think you're seeing those brands that have created a higher perceived value around themselves over the last 3, 4, 5 years, in some cases, but those perceived values where there isn't a replacement level product, those brands are continuing to succeed and lead the market in like where those categories should be going. It's really interesting to talk to potential clients or partners that are trying to pull along on the coattails of a certain category leader or someone who's broken the mold of an existing category, and they think they're going to do a similar thing, but those trends, they don't work their way back on how that brand arrived there and seeing what true value they've brought to that category or product line. So it's the following of those quote unquote trends and that word that I think gets a lot of brands into trouble. Because to me, I've always hated kind of the word trend, because typically when something has been established as a trend, it's probably on its way out. And for every trend, there's an opposite kind of brand or look and feel that also works and has been working or is starting to come up and work. So it's always that push and pull, especially within our industry, of like, how do you make sure you're satisfying kind of the look and feel of today with something that works for a brand, that's something that works for consumers. But the word trend always to me is a trap. It's always a trap, because that in and itself doesn't dictate true differentiation, true kind of perceived value. You're just leaning into something that may have a shelf life for the category that we work in a lot, but may have a shelf life that's not going to support you as a business.
Yeah, that makes sense, especially when it comes to design trends, right? Because it's by the time it's been acknowledged.
Right. Even dietary, even those types of trends come and go and they have a shelf life. So putting all your eggs in those baskets, to me, also can create an issue for
Yeah, that makes sense. And how we mentioned some of the, not tailwinds, what's the opposite? Headwinds that US brands are facing right now. Fortunately, not many tailwinds around these days. It's been a really tough few years. It has here as well. So we talked about brands that have created value within the category. What do you think are the other hallmarks of a resilient brand? What other things have you seen brands you look at that you think they're going to survive this versus the ones that possibly aren't?
I think, and I go back to that word, like perceived value, the ones that have built in a margin that they can play with. Margins are incredibly difficult, especially within FMCG, CPG, but the more you can push that value up, so it's not just a price discrepancy. I think while incredibly difficult is a value of brand and ownability and differentiation within your category. And then on differentiation as well, I think how a brand, whether it's been like simple or complex differentiation, so like simple could be bottle form or packaging form within the shelf that helps the consumer or differentiates on shelf, et cetera. The more complex ones would be proprietary ingredients, proprietary product development, those sort of things that protect you from co-mans. Those kind of simple and complex differentiations just continue to create like an ecosystem at which your brand can continue to live. I know a lot of times people talk about moats and how branding can be a moat, and I'm sick of those conversations as well. But I start trying to think of it more of an ecosystem where you can even have areas of your brand that potentially follow more trends, where social media can be of the moment, but still links back to your greater brand purpose and perceived value.
I like the idea of an ecosystem. I've not heard of the moat metaphor before.
Oh, yeah. Or it's the brand barriers, brand moats. Like the moat thing, I think, came up the last couple of years here. Like, how do you create a moat around your brand? And a lot of times people would just say brand is your moat. And it can be. It's part of it. But to me, it's this much greater ecosystem that can be relatively complex. And a brand like Moxie, Trey, how do we make something that complex push to success in a much simpler way or an understandable way that we can say, okay, how do we actually win within these contexts?
And then I guess it sounds like the brands that you work with, then you're pretty deeply involved if you're getting into a view of the whole ecosystem.
We, as much as we can and as much as they'll allow us to. But yeah, the more we know around, the more we know about certain production methods, resourcing, product resourcing, or ingredient resourcing, like the more we know about those things, the better we can position them for success. So it's always about that relationship pushing up and saying, hey, what else do we not know that could help inform this? Yes, this can be treated as a, maybe even as just a retail or a packaging project. But the more we know up the levels and layers, it's invaluable to understand that full company structure and ecosystem that we might find an avenue that links things else.
Do you love a factory visit?
I do, some more than others, but I think there's more and more teams. We're an exception that we can all get, Moxie Sozo is all in the Front Range in Colorado. We can get together in a week, but a lot of these brand teams and marketing teams are more spread out these days. So being able to get them together as well is so crucial, and remind them as well of their company and brand and what makes them successful. Yes, in-person workshops, in-person visits on a week. I think we have a warehouse visit that we're doing.
So I think it can also contribute to the creative process. I've worked on projects where that's happened. And I think there's a really famous, the most famous Audi campaign came from them going around and seeing a sign on the wall of the factory with some quote on it that became the tagline. And there's having that like full end-to-end understanding of the brand, the product. Sometimes there's some like tiny detail in that the people in the brand won't think about because they just see it every day. And then for an outsider, there's a bit of magic there.
Yeah. Absolutely. Those things that kind of they're ingrained in their culture that maybe they've forgotten that is actually different or that actually is interesting. And having someone who's I've worked on these other types of similar projects or brands, and they don't do that. They're like, I didn't know that. They just expect it. So that I love that example because it is. Or what's said in the room sometimes gets lost with a back and forth or a conversation and being able to extract those.
Yeah, and meeting as many of the team as you can, people outside of marketing. Yeah, I think there's a real case for brands opening their doors to their agency partners and sharing as much as possible, because when you keep things in silos, it just doesn't work within teams, within a business, within your relationships.
Yeah, that collaboration, that communication, it seems obvious, but to us, it's really key.
So do you think there is anything that UK founders could learn from how US brands are built, or even vice versa?
From a design perspective, I'm jealous of a lot of UK brands and the openness that I think the consumer has to trying and something new, or just being like less offended by anything. One of my friends in the industry as well was just in the UK, and some of the brands he was taking shots of, you're just like, I really am jealous of that. But that's not knowing how successful or unsuccessful they are. But it's those things that I, you know, just from a sheer designer standpoint, which is my background, that there's jealousy there. But the other way around, I think, I don't know if it's specifically with the US, but I think over here, how brands look at how large the market potential is in the US, which is, I think, lost sometimes at how big the different markets are. California, everybody's heard that California is the fourth largest economy in the world, those things. But how brands look to product market fit, the best ones, I think, and how they niche to grow, I think is really fascinating, especially when you get one that clearly succeeds in growth, like the Grazes and the Poppies, those are more recent success stories of the world, where these brands have been at it for a while and they didn't quite find their product market fit right away. And then once they hit those like smaller key differentiators and then just hammered that as much as possible, Graza with the reflection of high quality design, really differentiated product form, and having some fun with the olive oil category, which was all historical, looking at like quality of the Bertolli's of the world and those sort of things, that had, they weren't having any fun. And there comes this brand that's like speaking to a younger generation that isn't as familiar with olive oil. They took a bottle form that was back of house chef and made it the national brand it is now, but it was a niche brand. It was a natural market brand for a long time. And then same with Poppy, complete rebrand of a kombucha adjacent product. How about we make it soda? And now they've just continued to lean in and hone on that. And with them and Olipop leading the way there. And now we get a call like once a month about somebody creating a better for you soda. And they think they're going to break in. And you're like, okay, let's go back a few steps and talk about how we're actually going to make this work. But yeah, it's, to me, those niche markets too, and then how they continue to focus on kind of the market to grow with them nationally,
yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. I love that expression, niche to grow, because I think
they found a fit first, and they found somebody that they actually want this thing. And that, I think, is sometimes forgotten, like especially with the copycat people. So we're going to do this and we're going to make 2 grams less sugar. So no one's going to give a shit, if I can say that. they don't think that, like, where those people started and how they actually looked at differentiating. And sometimes you get lucky.
I was amazed at Expo West of how many new small gut health soda brands there were. And you just think, why?
It's, yeah. And we've worked on one for Evolution Fresh, which is an established juice brand. And so they had the right to create that. They had the distribution system already set up. They had some, hey, we're fine being third fiddle here. And because we have all these other things that we can take advantage of, well, many of them don't have those advantages. And you just ask them, like, how are you going to be successful? Are you going to go into are you going to hammer convenience in the South or something? It's like, how are you going to focus? So that focus sometimes, I think, gets lost, and forgetting kind of some of the simple things.
Yeah. Do you think there's any categories left to challenge or shake up? So obviously we just talked about Graza and olive oil. Is there any shelf of the supermarket that has not been?
How many business podcasts or how many business articles have there been written of identify a lost category that was forgotten and do this and update it to modern times? So I think that's the MO of a lot of these companies, like looking at underserved categories or aisles. Think of Fishwife and sardines, that maybe that was one of the last. There's always opportunity. That is a good question, though. If I had that answer, I think I'd be like keeping it to myself about this is the next opportunity category or product. But I think brand and this kind of approach to creating companies has infiltrated a lot of the grocery. And you have butt wipes with Good Wipes and Dude Wipes, like stimulating a category that needed it, but then saying, okay, now can I be third? Can I be fourth? What's my angle? It's tricky.
I love the brands, tricky. And they come very few and far between, but actually create new categories. So you're not just going in and putting like a cool brand on a shelf, which has been really boring for a while. It's actually changing the way we shop. And there's a brand here, Moju, which is a juice shop brand. And I feel like juice shops are a bit further behind in the US actually than they are here. So it's get these dosage bottles. And they launched, there was nothing else like that. And they got put with juices. And now in some supermarkets, there are entire fridges that are shots. And then they'll also weirdly sometimes have kombucha and maybe like coconut water in there. But it's changed the way that fixture is set up. So it's created a whole new load of space, which I think is harder to do, but is really exciting. And maybe that's where like the next wave of challenger brands are going to come in.
Yeah, or some sort of hybrid type category, right? Where it's like shots, it's like juice, but then it's also like fast serve, quick reaction. Yeah, there's a lot of the fridge sets in the US have started taking a lot of room for shots or refrigerated snacks or protein. That was an opportunity to take something that was somewhat familiar in another aisle and move it into an opportunity space. There's just less competition over here. Perfect Bar being a good example of a refrigerated bar. And now there's a few other brands that have infiltrated that little
space. We don't have space. That here. It hasn't happened. But, the like bar, you know?
Yeah. The refrigerator ones.
There's a couple of areas where I think we're really far behind. And one is that sort of fresh snacking things and chillers. And the other one is energy. Mm-hmm. So the US energy category, it's huge. Oh God.
Yeah, it's huge. There's another one coming out every day. Starbucks has a energy RTD now that they're, wow. I just saw a commercial this weekend on. They still see opportunity in it, which I think is fascinating because, yeah, Celsius has been the new market gold star. They've been around for almost 20 years. I think it's been 20. And they didn't quite find the right time. Again, sometimes it's about luck until 4 or 5 years ago that they really took off. And I think part of that was redesigning, finding the right product type, finding the right market. I think they really came up in convenience and than infiltrated retail and our traditional retail. But yeah, that's another market you keep having entrance because the pie is so big that people see the little slivers and they're like, if I can even just get that little sliver, that can buoy my company and my brand. But easier said than done.
I think also touched on it earlier, but that resilience, right? So sometimes like you say with Celsius, you've been working there for 15 years before suddenly there's a breakthrough moment, and actually just sometimes it's as simple as just staying in the game.
Yeah, survive in advance sort of thing, like any tournament. And yeah, it sometimes the market wasn't ready for you or your messaging wasn't quite right. And when you hit it, it can take it off. And so, yeah, they've been, that one's always an interesting one that people think they're a pretty new brand and you're like, not really. And I think it's surprising to a lot of folks, especially founders, that the days of getting huge funding and a quick exit are behind us. I know it's been talked about a lot recently, but are you going to be profitable? Do you actually have a market that you can succeed in? It doesn't matter if it's small, just make it successful. Make sure that you have some margins to play with, which again, all easier said than done.
I think it's good for those sorts of stories to be told though, because those perception of overnight success does nobody any favors. And I just, there might be one brand every 10 years that does that just somehow catches it exactly the right time and just goes boom. But more often than not, any brand that suddenly blows up has actually been working at that for 3, 5, 10 years. And it's a matter of timing. And sometimes it can be a pivot as well. Or you mentioned refresh, brand refresh for Celsius.
Yeah. Mother to Poppy.
So, let's talk about rebranding and refreshing now we're on the subject. When is that a good idea and when is it not a good idea?
I think it's a good idea when you've seen, okay, there's a few different ways to go about that. The refresh or updating, if something's not working, you're not getting sales up. It's obvious, especially if you've done like some consumer research and understanding like, is there an opportunity here? You've been in it for some years and you're just not seeing the success, then it kind of can become obvious. when some of the other factors, are you trying to jump aisles? Are you creating a new product line? Does your brand architecture support that? Does your product architecture support that? Sometimes you see these brands just create a new brand or create a subline and without really thinking, how does that play into the bigger picture? So I think that's, you can sometimes, hey, we created all these new products and we didn't really do it in the right way. So that taking a step back and saying, okay, let's kind of refresh this to make it, make sure it all makes sense together, make sure it has a future together. You want to be refreshing. You don't want to be refreshing every 1 or 2 years. You want to be doing it with bigger chunks, hopefully it's supporting it for 5+ years more. And that's why I talk about the ecosystem too, is like, how have you created a brand that can flex up and down throughout those 5 years? So you're not just having to burn and always update when it's not a good idea. And I've heard this from folks, is when the team is bored, when the marketing team is like, hey, we just want more assets, or we just want new assets, we just want new thinking. And it's like, sometimes don't break what's not broken. I understand the kind of want for new and excitement, or even when you're thinking about, we got to get ahead of the next thing. If it takes you 2 years to update your packaging on shelf because you're a massive brand, yeah, you should start thinking about that before you need it. But if it's just, we want some new stuff next year and we want to keep it fresh. And sometimes it's not always the biggest, that's always not always the biggest need, or it's not going to create the biggest kind of ROI. So there might be something smarter on methodologies or tactics that might provide a bigger ROI than trying to refresh a whole thing that's going to take a lot of money, a lot of time. And you're not rooting that in something that someone told you, like, or the consumers told you that you need to update something because it's not working. So that can get you into trouble. And is the whole company aligned with something like that? Or is it just like a certain team? So that's the times I'd say you don't need to do it unless you're trying to get ahead of the curve. And you see something that you need to do.
I think when there's you've got specific feedback that's undeniable and it's consistent.
Right. Yeah.
From if you've consumers, got some data, not from,
you are talking to consumers. Yeah. Even buyers and retailers, right? Sometimes you're like, that's not necessarily who you want to be listening to. They might give you some insights on what's working elsewhere or where to maybe extend your brand. But yeah, those get like that consumer level feedback, even if it's more qualitative, like listening and seeing adjustments. Yeah, I agree. And over the last few years, we've added a lot more research capabilities and qual capabilities that you're just smarter when you start executing, even if you're really trying to push a category.
I think there's certain things if you're a small brand and 50 people tell you they couldn't read the flavor name on fixture, like, you've got to change it.
Exactly.
If the founder's son doesn't like the font, like, that's a no. The frustrating thing about packaging is it's so subjective. So every person I know who's tried to lead a packaging redesign or refresh client side, you'll tear your hair out because you show it to people. Showing it to people within the business, everyone's got an opinion. And even with buyers, like you say, that's one person that's subjective, and always just try and go back to the consumer, because also it cuts through all of that potential conflict as well of you not listening.
Yeah. And that's where it sometimes can just come back to some of the simple things. Can they find you? That's whether they like you or not might not matter. They find you. Do they understand what you are? And do they understand your potential perspective? You know, that's down the line, but literally, I don't care if they've got the bottle in your hand and they're like, I don't like this. So did you hand it to them, or could they spot you out of a lineup? So it goes back to some of those basics where breakthrough matters, attention matters. And we know that the attention span is less and less, the seconds become less and less. So if you're not even registering, I don't really care what their opinion of you is. They don't even know you exist.
And CPG is so impulse driven as well. People you need to make their lives easier when they're at the fixture. It's got to be super clear.
Yes, yes. I talk a lot about consumer versus shopper mentality. So consumers like to think they're smarter. And this tends to be on more of the marketing side, even social side, even a little bit on the e-commerce side. They have a little bit more time. They can read about something. I'm sophisticated. This is how I think. I only buy brands that relate to me. And that's the consumer brain. Once you're in a store or once you're now even doing getting like delivery groceries, right? Going through and selecting all the stuff you're going to get delivered to you. It's much more of a shopper mentality. And what do I need now? What else is going in the background, whether it's at home or at the retail shelf that I'm worried about, or do I need to get to someplace? A lot of that consumer thinking goes out the window. Now you have the shopper mentality, which is, I just need this. I'm going to grab this one. Oh, that price is lower today. I'm going to grab that. And there's some of that persona, those personas that we build and have so precious, goes out the window because the shopper mentality is much more like tactical and just, I need this, I need that, I need to go. And they're already off and on. So I always like to talk about consumer versus shopper mentality, because what they say over here sometimes isn't how they...
And why sometimes there's nothing, we talked about hanging out in factories, but also just hanging out in grocery stores.
Hanging out at a store. Talking to actual consumers. We definitely creep on consumers in aisles a lot. And retailers have gotten way more lax. They don't tell you to put your phone away or not take photos. I haven't gotten talked to in years. But yeah, you're always like, who's going to point us out that we're just standing here?
I just like it. My kids think I'm weird because we go to the supermarket. Mm-hmm. Firstly, I take pictures of all the shelves of things anyway, because I'm always looking at them when I get home. I'm like an absolute loser.
My wife hates going to the store with me, and she's, no, what are you doing? Like, stop, put that down. You're not going to buy it. I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to look at it though and take my three shots and
then watch people watch the shoppers hanging out. Like, they pick stuff up, they put it back. You're like, why? Why did you do that? Watch the type of people. Yeah. I used to be in-house at brands, just go and hang out, mostly in the crisp aisle. And it's surprising as well. It'd be someone walk down and I'd be like, oh, here they come. Here comes our consumer persona. And then they just keep walking.
Yeah, they're definitely going to buy it. Yeah. They grab your direct competitor and walk out.
That's not what you're supposed to do. Okay. So why? We've talked a bit about differentiation. Talk about consistency as well and getting that balance. Right. Why does consistency matter? And what are the key things to keep consistent, do you think?
Consistency has so much to do with that perceived value that you're trying to create and within that ecosystem, right? Going back to your brand strategy versus your marketing strategy at times can be at odds. The brand strategy stuff, that's the stuff that you got to be so consistent with your tone of voice, with who you're targeting and how you're from a brand center point. When you get into the marketing strategy, you can start segmenting that down and trying different tactics throughout. I think so much of how you're showing up in the variety of different brand avenues that you have to have now and marketing mix that you have to have now, everything is omni-channel for the most part, or most brands are. We're trying to be just, are you gaining people's trust with the consistency of just how you show up and how you talk about yourself and that kind of business foundation? Are you being true to that? I go back to, we use a lot of brand pyramids, and there's all different sort of formats that you can use, right? Brand keys, brand pyramids, brand foundation, whatever you call it. Those are the ones that we always ask the questions, like, are we laddering back up to these things that we deemed so valuable that we put them at the core of the brand, and being able to ask questions throughout executions that, does this relate back to this, relate back to that? That's where I think the consistency always has to be maintained. As soon as you start like not acting like yourself or that goal, it won't be detrimental if you only do it like once or twice, but the more you do it, there's just a lack of understanding of what you stand for, what you previously created. Where's the trust or the foundation that you built with that consumer that held you on a higher, that really loved you? And that's, as if it's a premium brand and then they start preaching about, look at all these sales and discounts that we have at this place and that place and that, you're like maybe they aren't as, maybe the product's not as good as I thought, or maybe they're just, I don't have a great example of that, but I think that price is the most basic. If you've positioned yourself as a premium brand and now you're trying to justify price or cut price just to compete, like, you're not really being true to how you positioned yourself for however many years or however many months. And so you're talking to your consumer in a completely different way. It goes visually as well, right? Does it reflect those, maybe you only have one core thing or three core things, but does it reflect that? Or are you the way you look and the way you talk about yourself completely at odds?
It also goes back to that boredom thing again, doesn't it? Of, as if you've been for a while, you probably should be bored. If you're not bored, you're probably changing things too much.
Yeah, that's true. It is hard to be really consistent, especially with there's so many avenues and opportunity, quote unquote, opportunities that may come to your door. But that's, like you said, like you should know those things and hit them as many times
you can. Have fun, like you said, you can have fun and experiment a bit with the tactics, can't you? So the marketing strategy is where you can not be bored, but the brand.
Exactly. It's like the marketing strategy can be year to year, quarter to quarter, but making sure that all ladders up to this over here. So that's why ad agencies have a little bit more flexibility with brand assets and creatives. Hey, we know we can continue to evolve this. And as long as we're playing in the brand sandbox, we're going to create something that works. But yeah, the diligence can get difficult.
Right, last couple of questions. What are a few brands to watch right now?
That is a good question. I'm trying to think of categories. Yeah, I think that ship may have sailed a little bit. I think a quick tangent, like another thing is just who's going to win and who's staying true to themselves with all these, like the protein push and that, especially here in the States, just every brand, whether they've got a line or trying to create a line, pushing into that. And it's, who does it ring true for? And who does it seem like just another grab at some share? I really like what, speaking on the protein and hitting timing right, I really like what Good Culture has been doing the last few years. Their cottage cheese, which is not like a sexy product or hasn't been for a long time, but real milk, actual protein, like not super over the top, but they've evolved and stayed in the game long enough to have be right place, right time. And I really love how that brand's continued to stay true to themselves in a lot of ways. They didn't win on some wacky gimmick necessarily, not even like product form. They're just like a more contemporary version of cottage cheese, and it's really worked for them. I really like what they continue to do. Trying to think of, I think you all might be ahead of us on non-alc and some of those things. It's going to be interesting to see what other brands come out of non-alc that are seen as like high level successes. For us right now, it's like Athletic Brewing is like a high level success. Everybody's like wishes they would have got in on it with them. We've got all the big beer, wine, spirit brands coming out with their non-alcs, and some of them will be more successful than others. But I think Athletic leading the way there, seeing where they're going to take that category in non-alc beer, especially with everybody nipping at their heels, will be really interesting. And I'm curious what other non-alc brands might come out of it that are seen as true leaders in the category, because that one's starting to get really flooded really quickly, but everybody sees the opportunity in it.
We've got some nice...
As consumers, just...
Yeah, unless... One thing I noticed, I was speaking to the founder of Dessoir, CEO of Dessoir, and she was saying that it's very RTD dominated over there, whereas here it's a lot more like spirit alternative, so like big bottle that you have with tonic or soda. Yeah. But there's a couple of really nice brands, and you're starting to see them more in restaurants and bars. And I think there's something interesting in one of them, a brand called Mother Root, who are coming on the podcast. It's like a ginger ACV lemon. So you get like a real kind of buzz from it, but it's completely non, it's got no caffeine in it. It's just from the ACV and the lemon and the ginger kind of makes you feel really awake. So I think that kind of a bit of functionality, but without going crazy on the ashwagandha, it's stuff that you can feel that when you're socializing, that it closes the gap. Because also a lot of them are very expensive, the non-alcoholic gin.
Yeah, I was going to ask, Dessoir, like, I've purchased it a few times. It's hard for certain, from an American consumer, to stomach, like, purchasing a non-alc that is as much or more than the alcohol alternative. And she's done a good job having a very premium position brand. So she's not showing you something that doesn't look like it should cost what it does. But yeah, and I see that being a tricky one on the, especially the spirit alternatives, like how much some of those things cost to produce because you're trying to make up for some sort of function. So the ingredient profile can grow. So it'll be interesting if any of the more simple, can I get this price point back to what's expected or even less than what's expected for my alk alternative. But that kind of
I think the category shifts. I think consumer behavior is shifting there, because I think when not drinking used to be partly it'd be to save loads of money and you'd be like, this is great. And actually, I think as people are drinking less for lots of different reasons and are still looking to socialize and indulge and treat themselves, I feel like that is changing a bit. I think because things are starting to really take off here at those higher price points, I feel like there must have been a shift in how consumers are perceiving them and how much they're willing to pay. Otherwise, it just wouldn't work.
Yeah, and I think the continued understanding that it's so many of the consumers, it's about drinking less, not drinking at all. So having those, the alternative that I'm looking for isn't a mimic necessarily. You don't have to mimic the thing that I'm drinking you instead of. You can be your own thing. And I think a lot of the spirit brand or the non-alc spirit brands that are like, this is a concoction all of our own. This is an ownable flavor profile, potentially. Those are the ones I think are really interesting, where it's like, this is an enjoyable flavor profile that isn't trying to mimic something that you're missing. It's just an enjoyable beverage. And I think that's where that category will continue to go. Is this enjoyable on its own? And I'm not trying to be something else. Because that could even allow you, I want to position myself here to get in the market. But if I can start getting located other places, not having to get, we get ID'd on non-alc stuff. I don't know if you all do, which we get ID'd for non-alc stuff. It's funny. If your position is a 0% beer.
Wow. If I got ID'd, it'd make my day.
Yeah. My grace.
Okay, great. So final question we ask everybody, in your opinion, what makes a brand of tomorrow?
Belief. I've said that before. Do you believe in what you're building? Or did you find a trend that you think you're going to glom onto? I think what makes the brand of tomorrow is a true belief and the persistence of that belief to be successful, whether that takes you 2 years or 10 or 20. Moxie's going on 25. We're shooting for to be bigger. So it's keep showing up.
Great place to finish. Thanks so much, Derek.
Thanks, Ruth. Thanks.